piece that I read from is from a text called the Sutta Nipata, which is considered by scholars to be probably the oldest of Buddhist literature. And you find in this text repeated concern with views, holding views or opinions or theories about the world and about spirituality. And it seems that primarily the text warns against clinging to views. It doesn't. It can be argued it doesn't offer too many views of its own, but it offers. It warns us against the dangers of clinging to views. And last week here we talked about. I talked about non-clinging, clinging and non-clinging. And the Buddhist tradition gives three different main areas where human beings tend to cling. And the first is we tend to cling towards the world of desire, especially sensual desire. The second is the world of views, to opinions. And the third is to ideas of self. And if ideas of self are kind of like a view, then there's really two major clings, desire and to views. One may be more intellectual or cognitive, and the other perhaps can be understood as being more emotional. And I wanted to talk a little bit about views, since it's been on my mind a little bit, and because I think that it could be argued that views are some of the most tenacious places we tend to get stuck and hold on to. And even some of our emotional life it arises out of our attachments to our views and beliefs. I read a study recently about a neurologist, neuropsychologist, I guess, who was studying a 15-year-old boy who was epileptic. And because of his very strong seizures, epileptic seizures, they had cut the connection between the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere of his brain. So there's no direct connection. And so it was very interesting for neurologists to study them because you can kind of isolate the different hemispheres. And apparently this boy normally appeared quite normal. There was nothing strange about him. He was able to cope quite nicely. But the neuropsychologist had this machine where he could flash words on his kind of like a screen or something, so that only the right hemisphere of the brain of this boy would register, like only the right visual field, I guess, would register, or the right. And so he would flash on the word smile, and the boy would smile. But the left hemisphere didn't know it was smiling. And he would flash on like tap your finger, tap, and so he would tap his finger. But he didn't know he was doing it exactly. So then he typed on the screen, walk. At which point the boy got up and started walking out the door. And so the psychologist asked him why he was walking out the door. And the boy's answer was, oh, I want to go get a Coke. And there was nothing about going and getting a Coke in the instructions to go walk. And what the neuropsychologist kind of concluded from that is that it was an example of how the way the mind works, it tends to want to create meaning for the activities that we find ourselves in, situation we find ourselves in. And so he created a very reasonable meaning for what he was doing. He had to get up and walk, so maybe he was thirsty, so he created kind of a meaning for it. And the human mind is a tremendously powerful meaning-creating apparatus, machine, and it tends to make connections and find meaning and in situations in infinitely creative numbers of ways. Many times finding connections and meanings and explanations and theories for what's going on that maybe have very little to do with actually what's happening, or maybe sometimes it's has a little bit to do with what's happening. So one example is that maybe many of you had similar situation. But when I was in Thailand, I was asleep one night, and I was dreaming that I was walking up a kind of a knoll, a little hillside. And as I stepped over, I was kind of walking barefoot, and as I stepped over the top of the little knoll, there was a kind of a nail or something sticking out of the ground, and I stepped on it with my toe. And it was extremely painful. And I remember how painful it was, and then I woke up. And it took me a moment to realize what was happening was I was being bitten by these horrific ants they had in Thailand on my little toe. So there was a real event going on, and this wonderful creative mind of mine, in the context of my dreams, created a story to fit the experience. And I think that's often, how often does the mind make up stories that fits the situation outside of our dreams? And so often the mind creates views, theories, and we tend to find ourselves having opinions about everything, or many people have many, many opinions. And there's some problems with having opinions or theories or views. And one of the problems is if they're inaccurate. But also, one way that can be accurate is generalizations and generalizing about situation. And I certainly found myself in big trouble by generalizing in situations where it wasn't warranted to generalize even. I sat on retreat recently. An example in retreat was there was a couple of hours of sitting, a couple of hours during the retreat, where I kept trying my best to become concentrated, trying my best to be present. And my mind kept wandering away. It kept wandering away, completely lost and scattered. And I started getting discouraged because I thought, I was trying to get concentrated. I had kind of an agenda in mind, and I wasn't able to do it. And I started getting discouraged. And in my discouragement, I kind of concluded that I'm really a lousy meditator. And this is really a problem because here I'm supposed to be a meditation teacher. And what do I think I'm doing here, And this is really serious now. I don't know, do I go confess to someone? Do I resign as a meditation teacher? This is going to be like this forever. And it took me a while to kind of wake up to the fact that, I had made this big story about the fact that for a couple of hours my mind was a little more energetic than it usually was, and it was preoccupied with certain concerns. And that's what I needed to accept, not trying to get concentrated. But, my mind made this story. It took a while for me to see I was generalizing and not, that it wasn't just the way it was. It wasn't true. But it would have been very easy, I think. For some minutes or some time there, I believed that was an accurate description of the universe. That this universe I found myself in was a universe in where I was a really lousy meditator. And that's the way it was. It was always going to be that way. And that wasn't a true view or opinion, but I had made that generalization. And I think I came across recently one of the probably greatest generalizations that are found in maybe in religion, but we'll just say, stick to Buddhism. In ancient India, they had they believed in many gods. And even though Buddhism is sometimes considered an atheistic religion because gods don't have an important place in them, Indian Buddhists believe in the gods of the Indian pantheon. But for the most part, the Buddhists kind of feel sorry for the gods. They don't have a really high opinion of them. But there's one god that the pantheon of deities has a hierarchy, and there's a top of the hierarchy which is Brahma, the ruler of the gods. And sometimes Brahma is taken to be a kind of the creator of the universe, creator of the world. And the Buddha wanted to explain how this notion was kind of a false generalization, and how this kind of notion could arise. And Buddha, so he started by explaining, well, in Buddhism, the belief is, or in ancient Indian religions in general, they believed the universe lived, continued through time through periods of expansion and contraction. And in periods of complete contraction of the universe, all physical matter disappeared. And the only place that beings, sentient beings or consciousness survived was these disembodied luminous spirits or luminous states of consciousness that floated about being quite happy and blissful in some ethereal realms. But then as the universe began to expand again, then these ethereal realms would start to solidify, and you start having the world again and people again, all this stuff. But as it begins to solidify, the first thing that's created, the first solid thing that's created, is the palace of this god Brahma. It's just an empty palace. And then at some point, these luminous, mind-made, disembodied kind of things hovering ethereally, they have certain lifetimes. They only live for a certain length of time. And so at some point they die. And when you die from these higher states, you get reborn in the lower one. And the only lower place to get reborn at this point was Brahma's empty palace. So one of these beings got reborn in Brahma's empty palace. And he was kind of living there for a while, hanging out. After a while, you know, got kind of lonely, being all alone there. So he thought, wouldn't it be nice if there were other beings here to keep me company? Now, coincidentally, at the same time, some other beings in this ethereal, mind-made kind of luminous bodies exhausted their lifespan up in the ethereal places and died up there and were reborn where it's more solid, which was in Brahma's palace. So Brahma thought, oh, I had this thought and they appeared, so I must have created them. So I'm, you know, the great creator. And I'm he has these wonderful titles, the all-powerful, the all-knowing, the creator of everything, the master of the universe, and he thought he was pretty hot. And now these beings that were born in Brahma's palace, they also have only lived for a certain length of time. It's a really long time, maybe, you know, hundreds of thousands of years, but it's limited. But some of them who were born there after Brahma had a shorter lifetime than Brahma. So they died from there and were born as human beings, leaving Brahma to be the ruler of his palace. And some of these beings born human beings became monks and ascetics, nuns, and practiced meditation. And it's said that you can, in some states of meditation, you can review your past lives. So one of these monks had kind of limited psychic powers, and he could only review one past lifetime, which was his lifetime when he lived in Brahma's palace. And he remembered that there was this being who was there before he got there and was there after he got there, and seemed to think that he was the creator of the universe, and it must be the case. So therefore he concluded that there is such an all-powerful creator of the universe, this guy Brahma. And so they created a theistic religion. But the Buddha said that this was a generalization, because indeed psychic powers are possible, psychic perception or extrasensory perception is possible. But to make this conclusion that just because there was a being there before you got to the palace and he's there after you left, conclude then that this person's all-powerful and the creator of the universe, that's kind of going a little bit beyond the evidence. And so this is the way the Buddha kind of wanted to kind of maybe loosen people's attachments to the idea of creator deities. But it's an example of a generalization. Another kind of generalization that we have is what's called in anthropology magical thinking. And this is when people make connections of causality between one event and another. And I read in Dear Abby this last week an example of this. Maybe some of you read it too. It was a list of 10 things which you shouldn't say to couples who are trying to have children. And one of the items was this idea that, oh, if you just adopt, then you can have children. Then you can get pregnant, you can conceive. Because sometimes, apparently, people adopt and then they conceive. It's kind of like, wow, you know, we tried all these years, and then we gave up, and we had children, we adopted, and then, poof, we conceived. And so there's this idea that that's, you know, all you have to do is get adopted, and so you relax, and then you see whatever, and the pressure's off, And that idea circulates around enough that Dear Abby felt she had to address it. And what she says, and I've read this elsewhere too, is that 5% of all couples who adopt children conceive after the adoption. And 5% of those who don't adopt also conceive. And And this is kind of how I believe a little bit how things like rain dancing perhaps works. Is I don't know if rain dancing is the right example. I just pulled it out of my mind right now. But if you do certain rituals that are supposed to have some effect on the universe, on the rain or something, it might work 1% of the time, because once every 100 days it's going to rain. But we only remember the times it really worked. And maybe sometimes it's a real coincidence that it works. And so it really stands out as being, that's what's remembered, the great coincidence when it worked. And the 99 times that it didn't work, people long since forget. And this is the kind of generalizations that people make a lot, especially I think in some spiritual circles or New Age circles. And there's a wonderful book I recommend. I forget the author, but the book is called Innumeracy. People who are kind of the opposite of, I guess, the corollary of being illiterate. It's people who don't...
Paula?
Paula? Paulus? Innumeracy. It's kind of for people who don't understand how numbers work or how statistics works. And it's a kind of an attempt to kind of show, overcome the kind of faulty thinking that can come when we don't understand the statistical possibilities that things are supposed to happen, coincidences are supposed to happen. He says in the book that it'd be really weird if coincidences didn't happen. That would be really weird. Because a certain amount of time, like if you roll the dice, you know, a certain amount of time, you're going to end up with all the different possibilities. There'll be enough times when if you roll two dice, there'll be occasionally that both sixes come up. And that's just, you know, if both sixes never came up, that'd be really weird. Now some coincidences, you know, are one in a million. You know, that's a pretty rare thing, one in a million. But when you think that there's, how many million Americans? 300 million? Is that what we have now? That means that one in a million chances supposed to happen 300 times a year. So you expect it to happen. But then you don't want to make this big kind of metaphysics about causality and it should have happened and God meant it to happen or it was in the stars or whatever. Generalizations. Mark Twain wrote, "When I was 13, I thought my dad was the stupidest fool that I ever came across. By the time I was 20, I was surprised by how much he had learned in 7 years." In this text, the Sutta Nipata, it's very critical of people who attach to views and opinions and theories. But it says very carefully that it's not through views and opinions that a person becomes peaceful. But it's also not through not having views that we become peaceful. And the point is not, you know, to avoid all views. But the point, I believe, in this text is how we hold views, how we relate to them, and what their function is in our lives. And part of what we do in mindfulness practice is to understand how we are clinging and understand how we hold our views and hold our opinions. And as I kind of made this plea last week, one of the things we want to be very sensitive to when we do mindfulness practice is to our suffering. Whenever we feel some kind of big anxiety or fear or unworthiness or inadequacy or embarrassment or whatever, is to spend some time and see what's going on here. What is the clinging that has caused us to have this suffering? And what we'll often find is that some of this clinging arises out of views and opinions that we have and the way we hold those views and those opinions. So it could be that I'm the worst meditator in the world, as I thought those 2 hours. I mean, maybe that's true. I don't know. But so, let's say it's true. So what? You know, but I got all flustered and upset and made all these conclusions and decided to go into a different profession. And you know, I made all these conclusions because I was upset about it, right? I mean, so there was suffering because I reacted to that opinion. I reacted to those thoughts in a certain way. I was clinging to a certain view that I had to be a certain way. So can we notice if we pay attention to when we're suffering, when we're anxious, then can we start to note, one of the things we can notice is not just simply the clinging, but what are we clinging to? What are the views and the opinions that have to be in place to hold it? And the way many of us, I think, in our culture hold opinions, hold views, it isn't simply that we're trying to state the truth. You know, we kind of impartial observance of the truth, and it just seems like it's a nice thing to kind of put the truth out on the table and let everybody else kind of see it also. But there's a lot else going on when we kind of hold an opinion or hold a view. And to understand what that is, I think, is very interesting. I think many times having an opinion is a kind of a flag saying, here I am, pay attention to me. And the truth is not so important as making some kind of statement or about the self, being someone, of standing out, of standing in contrast to someone, or being in comparison to other people around, or have them notice you in good ways. So when you go to eat at a restaurant, and you go home to a friend and you say, I ate at the best restaurant, the very best, that was really fantastic. And we kind of go into these kind of adjectives that are really kind of exaggerated. That's a view for sure. Why are we doing that? Why do we exaggerate, some of us, about our activity? That was really the best vacation I ever had, you know. And maybe it wasn't even true, but I think I hear a lot of people who exaggerate. Some people have a kind of this natural way of talking. Everything's the best. And what are they saying, really? What are they getting across in their communication? And I think sometimes they're making statements about themselves. Look what a good person I am. Look how wonderful I am that I was able to do this wonderful thing. Or maybe it's a kind of, I don't know what's going on, maybe. Some people fear that if they don't have an opinion that they're boring. So they start collecting opinions. Ready to use. The famous writer Aldous Huxley. The story is that before he went to cocktail parties in L.A. in the 60s, he used to memorize an entry from the encyclopedia. So he can come to the party kind of with this kind of little, you know, paragraph of fact or something to pontificate about. And the problem with clinging to views is that even if something is true, we can cling to it to our detriment. The clinging is the problem. So even something which is really true can be a source of anxiety and fear and suffering. And one of the wonderful lists that the mindfulness tradition has is a list of the 10 spiritual clingings that are peculiar to mindfulness students. So you probably want to hear about those. Or would you rather live in ignorant bliss? There's 10 of them, and the first one is light, experiences of great light, which happens sometimes in meditation. The second is knowledge. The third is happiness. The fourth is tranquility. The fifth is joy. The sixth is resolve. Seventh is effort. The eighth is, guess? Mindfulness itself. The ninth is equanimity. And the tenth is views. Now that seems like a strange list, huh? They're kind of many of the things that people are most wanting to get out of the meditation is that which is sometimes the greatest trap for people to do mindfulness practice. Because we form a view around it, usually, we get attached to it. And attachment sometimes arises because of it's very pleasant. It's a very pleasant thing. But more tenaciously, there can be attachment because it supports a sense of self that we feel we need to have in order to feel secure in the world, or important in the world, or adequate in the world, or worthy in the world. So if we can have a lot of knowledge, or if we can be clever, or if we can be the person who has the greatest amount of, if we have really blissed out in meditation, then it really proves that we really attained something, we've gotten somewhere, and you can wear that as a little badge. And as we pay as you pay attention to the way we hold views and theories, when we form, when the judging mind, when the attached mind, when the clinging mind holds onto views, you can feel what that's like sometimes in the mind and the body, as a kind of contractedness, kind of a hardness, kind of restrictedness, kind of a narrowness of both one's vision, but also of one's mind and one's body. And it actually can feel painful to be attached to an opinion or a view about how things should be. And views and opinions, you know, are the can be a full gamut of phenomena. But for people who meditate, there are such views as I'm a good meditator, I'm doing it right, or I'm doing it wrong, or am I making progress, or this is the kind, I'm not making progress, or this is the progress I'm making, or there's all these ideas that we have about our meditation practice, which are views and opinions about it, which, you know, a view and opinion is just a condition of the mind that arises, but then we believe it, we buy into it, and then off we go spinning, you know, a story about how maybe we should do Tai Chi instead. In the early Buddhist literature, the word views is ditti, and views is a good translation for the word ditti, because ditti has the same connotations of seeing as view has in English. But when the word view appears by itself in an unqualified form, it almost always means wrong view, because views are such, Buddhists tend to be so suspicious of views and holding to views. There are good views, there are right views that they offer in Buddhism, but what my view is lately is that for the most part, Buddhism, or early Buddhism, the Buddha, spent a fair amount of time kind of debunking, or in a kind of Socratic method, technique, he would ask people questions about the views they held. So that in asking them questions about their views, they would realize themselves that these views were empty and were kind of didn't really hold up. And he spent a lot of time doing that. But the Buddha very seldom offered views of his own, opinions of his own. And I think my understanding is the Buddha wasn't that interested in offering explanations of how the world worked exactly, kind of great cosmic metaphysical stories about creation or many things. But rather, what the Buddha was interested in was our suffering, was our clinging, and the possibility of living peacefully as an alternative to a life that's full of suffering and stress. And in order to live a life that's peaceful, you don't necessarily need to understand the world. You don't necessarily have to even understand yourself and all your, you know, in all the different ways you can understand a human being. You have to understand very simply the way that we cling, the way we hold on and get attached, including the ways we are aversive. And one of the things that we learn, one of the great maybe lessons from a spiritual life or from meditation, is to learn a place, learn about a way of being that is at peace with oneself and with the world around one. And to see that one's peace is not dependent on holding on to a view or an opinion or a theory or some kind of particular way things have to be, that it's possible to have a level of peace that's not conditioned by any of those things. And you find that, and it's relatively, you know, relatively, maybe not easy enough, but it's relatively easy to experience that in meditation. It's also nice to go on retreat, because on a longer retreat, retreats are kind of, maybe you'll excuse the pun, but it's kind of like a retreat from having to have a lot of views. Life on a retreat is very, very simple. And the normal ways in which we feel we have to present ourselves and construct our universe is no longer operating so much. And so you can drop it, and at least for those days. And you find a way that, you find a kind of peacefulness, a way to be at ease, that that then it becomes a familiar place, and is an alternative then to living a life that's stressful, or holding on, or really tight, or narrow-minded. So, you know, those 2 hours where I was discouraged and wondering whether, you know, I must, you know, I'm in the wrong business and being a meditation teacher is not, you know, right for me, and all these kinds of thoughts, I could see how I had a sense of self that was tied up with being a meditation teacher and being a good meditator and all these kinds of things. And when I saw it all, I was able to relatively quickly kind of to drop it and let go of it and realize that in order for me to be at peace and be kind of at ease, I had to kind of forget completely about being a meditation teacher, at least in terms of my identity and my ego, my sense of self. And that to live in the world without holding on to certain concepts of who I should be is to enter a world which is unknown, in a sense. And but if you're not willing to enter a world which is unknown and kind of be unknown to yourself even, I think it's very hard to be at peace. So they say in Buddhism that the point of mindfulness practice is to see things as they are. And one of the implications of that is to see things as we directly perceive them without overlaying generalizations and opinions about what's going on. Or if we do overlay opinions and views, which sometimes we need to do, then to take the time to check it out with others, to see, kind of get a reality check and see is the way you're interpreting the situation the way other people are interpreting it. So, questions, comments, anything that you'd like to? Yes?
To fall directly into error, I suppose. What do you know was the determination of why? I mean, what determined the order of those 10 preoccupations?
Oh, I have no idea.
Because it seemed like a very strange
order. I don't know. Some of these things appear in other lists in orders that make more sense. But
it's,
I don't know.
Commonality, I wouldn't have thought.
Which one?
I wouldn't have thought it would be an order of commonality.
I have no idea. It could be that the person who drew it up, that was the order they experienced it. I don't know. Yes.
It seems like trust is really important when I think about going into the unknown. That's the first thing, to let go and to trust it.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to impose order on something. And letting go and trusting is helpful.
Yeah. And one definition of enlightenment is when one's trust has become all pervasive. Mm-hmm. So you can be at ease in the universe, in the world. Yeah, trust is very important. So what brings trust for you?
Feeling love.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things I was thinking about today about views is that part of the problem with views and opinions is sometimes they function to separate us from others. If we hold on very tightly or dogmatically to a certain view, the stronger the holding is, the stronger we tend to separate ourselves from others. And one way to hold views, one way to be involved with views or be involved in the world, is to notice the difference between what separates us ourselves from others and what brings us in some place, some sense, more connected to others, allows us to love others more. And I think true love doesn't arise out of views. If anything, views tend to obscure the possibility of love. So I talked about peace earlier and the possibility of finding peace. But I think there's also a possibility of finding love. And when the barriers and that we set up dissolve. Yeah?
This is the hardest area of Buddhism for me, called one.
That's good.
Yeah, I realize that. It's difficult for me. I find myself sometimes around views, being just around the people who agree with me. I've said to myself sometimes, I will not have for a close friend, I cannot have someone who has this particular view. And it's a difficult contest inside me to measure between views and passion, because passion is permissible in my vocabulary.
Uh-huh.
And but it creates, it is a sticky wicket when you take a stand or when you are an activist or, you know, of any kind, regardless of your views. And yet, inaction or passivity, which is not what I think you're encouraging,
no,
there's a temptation for people to blend, and it's a, what you're asking in terms of people who are really interested in developing their lives, a very hard thing.
I think so. And our society encourages us to have views and our friends and everything. But we have to have views and opinions if we're going to participate in a responsible way in our society. But how do we hold them? And do we hold them as dogmatists, holding this is absolutely the right way? Or do we understand them perhaps more pragmatically, that in certain contexts this might be true, or in this particular time, but things change, and then can you change with the changing times? And there are times when just that, I mean, there are times when it's appropriate to vote yes, and other times it might be appropriate to vote no for the same situation, depending. So to understand the views, kind of hold them lightly, we're quite willing to change them, is one of the things that's required. And what you see a lot is people who stick to a view because, you know, they're going to be a Democrat because their father and their grandfather was a Democrat, or Republican, or whatever. They kind of, that's the way things are. They're going to hold that identity or that view and not be able to be flexible. But I was very surprised when I was about 20. I was, you know, kind of a born again hippie or whatever, you know, kind of way out there on the left. And I remember I took a chemistry class in college where my lab partner was a conservative Republican born again Christian. And at first I thought, uh-oh. But I learned very quickly to really like her a lot. I thought she was really a great woman. I kind of really delighted in her. And I was so surprised that I could really feel some friendship and warmth and delight in someone who was, you know, such a different end of the whole spectrum of political and religious and everything beliefs. And I realized that friendliness and open-heartedness and kindness weren't dependent on the beliefs that the person held. And so that loosened me up quite a bit to be open and receptive to people around me. So I don't know if that's a response to you. I mean, what you said, I think, was really true, that I think it's hard to
respond.
To response.
But it takes what I say rather likely.
Rather likely.
If I hadn't made more difficult problem.
Yeah, I think it's a difficult one. Maybe I haven't thought about it as deeply as you have. The floor is open for other people to respond also, to Dick or to something else.
Sure.
Yeah?
Earlier you mentioned causality, and I think I heard you saying that the idea that we're not, that it's not helpful to have really strong ideas about what causes what. But it seems like several times when I've read little pieces of Buddhist literature, there have been these phrases about causality and how important causality is, and everything is related and everything causes everything.
Yeah.
What
causality is very important, but seeing causality is one thing, but generalizing about causality is another. So, for example, I mean, what's a good example? I mean, if
I
my mind's kind of blank about the good example. But I mean, you can kind of, I mean, sometimes you can obviously see that if you do, I mean, an example would be that if I went out there and put on my shoes and felt like I was in a hurry to get home, and I stepped on someone else's foot as I was walking out the door, well, I can see the causality to that in part is that I was in a hurry and anxious and trying to get somewhere. But if I decide that from that one event that I'm a harried person and inconsiderate and not a nice person, because once I happened to step on someone's foot, that's a different realm of understanding causality. The causal connection was I was in a hurry that particular time, and I happened, because of that, perhaps I stepped on someone's foot. But to make a speculative leap and say, well, because of that, I'm a lousy person, that's not in the realm of causality anymore. But the reason why Buddhists want to understand causality, and very important to understand causality, is that we want to take some responsibility for our actions and live in a way that doesn't create more suffering for ourselves or the world around us. But sometimes Buddhist description of causality and karma, especially when you talk about karma, tends to lend itself more in the kind of the superstitious or the magical realm, or in the realm of belief and metaphysics. You have to kind of take it on faith, certain statements that Buddhists make about karma. But I think that the notion of causality is extremely important. It's it helps us, understanding causality helps us make useful, pragmatic decisions about how to live our life. You know, if you see that X causes, X tends to cause Y, then you can decide whether you're going to do X or not. So if you notice that, if you yell at your spouse every day when you get home, that the rest of the evening is kind of lousy. You've seen a causal connection. But maybe you want to kind of be careful with how you come home. Resolve or determination is it's possible to have a very kind of steady, very strong resolve, kind of actively determined, this is what you're going to do. And that resolve, having that kind of steady, very strong resolve, can be a great source of energy and power to actually motivate one in a spiritual life. However, a person can get attached to that resolve. The resolve itself becomes kind of the be-all and end-all. And so one is attached to the resolve, to that power of determination, and that becomes a hindrance because you're holding on to that rather than learning to let go.
It's not so much in trying to resolve issues.
Oh, I think it's more determination in that sense.
Pause.
Last question, and then we'll stop.
Kind of getting back to what Professor Ellman was saying, and we got into kind of talking about society and opinions. One of the things that came to my mind as you were starting to do that is I'd like to send something like that statement to Rush Limbaugh, and then I started to think about that, and one of the things that troubles me personally about society, I don't listen to that type of thing, but every once in a while I'll turn on the radio just to see what are they doing there. And what makes me feel very sad and sometimes worried and despondent when I hear what's going on there is my simplistic definition of good is bringing oneness, things that bring oneness, and evil is things that bring separation. And what I hear is this constant preaching of separation through opinion, through, you know, if you don't think this way, you're not one of us, you're one of them. And I have to say that it scares me, and that so much of our society is built upon that. And sometimes I find it difficult to, you know, I know that trying to become part of the solution rather than the problem, but I think it's an important issue, and it centers kind of around opinions and how we use opinions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And try to, you know, how it's such a big thing in our society that creates so much separation.
One of the kind of meta issues that is very important for American culture is the whole notion, the whole idea of what are beliefs? How do we hold beliefs? And the great opposition is between those who are absolutists, who believe there are absolute values, absolute kind of Bible-given kind of truths, and you have to live by those regardless. On the other hand, those who believe that beliefs are relative or conditioned. Between these two points of view, and it's very hard then to reconcile these views about how to hold views. And so I think thinking about it is very important, and how we respond to other people's views and what kind of views we hold is I think an important issue to address. One of the things I thought about in while you were talking about this is that, and perhaps it begins to address Dick a little more directly, is in Buddhism, we're very, very interested in intention. So regardless of what a person's view is, what is the intention behind that view? And if the intention is to create discord or create hate, then I think a Buddhist would be very strongly against that. But two people can have the same view with different intention. And so someone person can actually have the intention behind it is actually to create a safer, more secure place for their community. That, and maybe it's misguided, who knows? Another person's view is to is just out of spite, and they're angry, and they want to really create a segregated society. And so but it's the same view, they're holding the same view. And if you understand that the intention is behind it, I think we'd have a different reaction to the different people. And also, I think it's very hard to have a serious conversation with someone unless you understand the deeper intention behind them. Because often views, the reason why some people hold views is not always so logical. So if you try to meet them directly at a logical place, you don't always, you kind of miss each other unless you understand sometimes the emotional or the intentional level that's below it, that's holding it in place. But regardless of how you hold views or what you think about views, I hope you all have a chance to discover what it's like to be alive without, at least for a little bit, without holding on to any of them. Good luck. Thank you.